Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Mike DeZenon, recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me, I have Rula Kaminara, all the way from Brussels. Welcome, Rula.
Thank you, Magda, for the invitation.
Rula has an exceptional CV. She is a non-resident fellow at Georgetown University in Qatar. She also has an exceptional record of leadership in public service management and in diplomacy. And she's also broken one or two glass ceilings, which includes being the first EU representative that heads the representation in Pakistan.
Yes, I was the first female ambassador to Pakistan after 40 years of EU-Pakistan relations. So
let's say we have a lot to discuss, and we always have these long conversations. So let's start with that. Women in diplomacy, what different women and gender? Because we need to put in the qualification, because as we said, not all women bring in another dimension. Women in diplomacy, why do you think it's necessary? What extra dimension do you think they bring?
Well, first of all, in diplomacy, you need, like in any other sector of work, you need the best people at the table. So not having 50% of the population considered or less represented at the table means that you lose a lot of talent. Secondly, women usually, particularly in countries where there are cultural issues, women have access to both men-only spaces. You know, as a woman ambassador, I was quite often in meetings where I was the only woman, but I was also able to speak to women groups where male ambassadors had no access because of cultural issues. So I think being a woman gives you access to the totality of the population, which a male counterpart would not have in particular cultural environments.
I think, sorry to interrupt, I think it also helps that you're not a local woman.
Yes, in some cases you're a, you know, you're considered almost a third gender in the sense that, you know, we have the men and women, the local men and the local women, and then there are this other type of women that come from abroad. Yeah. That is true, but for example, I've always worked on gender issues, and I wasn't going to stop working on gender issues just because I was ambassador to Pakistan. And I think it's important to remind that in the gender gap, global gender gap indexes, Pakistan is the worst country globally. The recent studies have come. So the challenge of being a woman ambassador there should not be underestimated. But I was very much aware that a foreign woman with the so-called third gender coming from abroad and telling them about the importance of inclusion would not be enough. They would be politely probably hear me, and that would be it.
So not their heads a bit, and yes, then just carry on.
So I decided to, in a way, come out of my comfort zone and try and convince the people that mattered, the people that
the decision makers.
Decision makers, and have them speak about gender. So the decision makers, apart from the government in Pakistan, of course, the role of the military is very, very big. And also the role of the religious leaders is very, very important in Pakistan. Let's take the military. I have to underline that the Pakistani military has a higher percentage of women in the military that most European militaries have. And in fact, Pakistan contributes to peace, UN peace operations with a higher percentage. I think it's one of the top first or second percentages. So the military, talking to the military about this issue, I didn't have to convince them. They were already practicing it. But what I did try to do was to convince them to speak openly about it. The other sector of society, the religious leaders, I have to say, were not something that I had ever done before. In a way, it was out of my comfort zone because in my previous work, I didn't really need to deal with religious leaders, and I didn't know how they would react to me.
And this was also your last posting before you retired. So you
Yes.
got your one of your most challenging
But
positions in your last posting.
I chose to go there. I was selected for four other countries, shortlisted, and I chose to go there saying, okay, what have I learned in this 30 something years career in the EU, and how can I use it better? And in fact, if you want challenges, Pakistan is the place because they have political crisis, humanitarian crisis, development crisis, you name it,
Climate
any
crisis. Every
crime.
kind of crisis is there.
Yes. So I actually very much enjoyed the time there, although it was quite obviously one of the toughest things I've ever done, but I like challenge. So if I go back to the religious leaders, I decided I was going to find the influential Muslim leaders and try and talk to them. And this was sort of a new thing, totally new thing for me, because it was uncharted territory, both from my side and obviously from them, you know, receiving this woman ambassador who wants to speak about inclusion, about we talked about other things as well, of course, from
Can
human
I
rights.
ask you something? What language are you communicating in, or did you speak the local, do you speak the local language?
No. English. Most educated Pakistanis would speak very good English. And in the rare cases where they did not, I would go in with an
A
interpreter.
translator.
Yeah.
Got to interpret. Okay.
And I was pleasantly surprised, I have to say, because I met people that were willing to talk once they got over the shock that, you know,
He is a woman, a white
yes,
woman.
a white woman. And I did not, let's say, change the way I behaved or the way I was dressed in any way in order to meet them. And in the end,
but you did wear the local clothes, didn't you? The local, what do they call the shawis? What's
no,
that?
no. I had some because they're quite comfortable, but I never covered my head in order to meet
Okay.
religious leaders and things like this. I put in place an initiative which was interfaith dialogue. So basically, religious leaders, not just Muslim, and of course Muslims, there's very categories of Muslims, Shia, Sunni, and other categories, Hindus, Christians, and through that, we defined a common approach to a number of issues, including gender issues,
That's
and every
quite very forward thinking that they actually agree to sit in an interfaith discussion, interfaith dialogue, to set this up.
not only that, but the first meeting was half religious leaders, half NGOs. In the
Wow, the
NGO,
inclusion of NGOs, the inclusion of civil
yes,
society.
exactly. And some of those NGOs were also NGOs promoting gender equality. We did manage to have a text which I think is quite forward-looking by anybody's standard. They all endorsed it, and they all also agreed that that was what they would preach in their respective religious, you know, in
Communities.
communities. So I'm proud to say that, and this we carried on for the 3 years that I was there. We talked about gender, we talked about climate change, we talked about respecting the other people's religion. And when I left, I got, I'm very proud to say, a prize by the president for promoting interfaith dialogue there. And some of these people, some of these khatibs and imams are still my friends, and I'm very proud that they are my friends. We have totally different views on a lot of topics, but they're very decent human beings trying to do the decent thing, and I'm proud to call them my friends.
Well, our
Just one
friends,
example.
we don't need to agree with everyone. We need to respect each other. So when
Exactly.
you actually have someone next to you or opposite to you, that you can totally disagree, but you can have a reasonable, not a reasonable, a balanced, calm discussion. There's nothing better, in fact, because it makes you a better person, I think. I find when
I
people
agree.
challenge me a little bit, I need to rethink certain things. And then it's I don't want people around me that always agree with me.
I'll tell you an example of something I had lived. While I was in Pakistan, there was the takeover of Kabul by the Taliban. And of course, following that, there were the measures that the Taliban took against girls' education. Now, the neighboring region to Afghanistan is Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is, I mean, Pakistan is 250 million people, just to give you a size. So I'm not sure how many, maybe 60 million is in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. The Khatib, which is the highest ranking Muslim there, was one of the participants of this group. And once the Taliban came out and said they would block girls' education past the age of 12, he was quite vocal to say that that's not what Islam says.
Oh wow. And it
Yes.
isn't. I mean, the
No.
Taliban and the extremists, it's not. Islam is actually quite inclusive religion, as most religions are. There's
Yes,
no
but
religion that says keep women out. It's the way
yes.
they are interpreted by the males that actually changes it and makes it.
In Pakistan, when a girl child is born, the family is congratulated. They welcome the girl child, which is and the average Pakistani respects women a lot. It's not the how shall I say, the thing that is portrayed about women. And I
That's
would
not what
say,
that's just. It's the opposite of what is shown abroad or
yes,
outside.
I can't say that everybody of the 250 million are like that, but the vast majority people in the street, that's what they are, and they do respect women and try to educate their girls. There's a lot of misconceptions about anyway Islam, but that's another story. So going back to gender, I think in whatever position one has, if there is sensitivity to this topic, then there are things that we could do. Let me tell you one of the experiences on joining the EU. I worked for the EU longer than I probably would like to admit because of my age. Anyway, I worked 32 years for the.
No, Rula, we wear this age with pride because
Oh, yes, I'm very, very,
age is a
very.
gift that not everyone gets, and it's been a
Exactly.
good life. Good life has been good
Exactly.
for most
Exactly.
of yes.
So when I came into the EU, I was very much motivated by promoting equality and inclusion. Very quickly, I joined an internal group which was promoting women in the sense that there was a very, very low percentage of women managers in the EU at the time, and we were trying to break them all. Old in a way. We have to keep in mind that the EU has been producing legislation about gender equality and telling member states that what they should do and things like this on gender equality. But if you look at the statistics when I came in, I think a manager at manager's level, it was something like 15 to 20% of all managers were women, even though most of the over 50% of the professional staff were women. So it was not an underrepresentation of women in the services. It was an underrepresentation of women as managers.
Okay.
So one of the first things we did, because people were saying, you know, there's all these misconceptions about what women would like or how women work and things like this. The first thing was, women don't want to be managers because they want to have spare time to balance private life and things like this. So we fought and won to have every director general publish figures on how many women apply for managerial post and how many women get the post.
And it
So
was
then in
tragic. Was it tragic?
yes, because in some DGs, if you had, let's say, 15% women applying, you would get more or less 15% women getting the post. In some other DGs, you will have 15% applying, 1% getting the post. So already you knew that there was a problem in these. DG means Director General. It means it was almost a name and shame. And I remember how much backlash there was when the first report was published, and people saying, "No, this is not true." So, one thing, one misconception that women don't apply and are not interested. Then there was another story about women work less than men
Well, it's quite
in
the
the.
opposite, Adnan.
Exactly.
Quite the
So
opposite.
basically, what the study found out, because they tracked how many hours people were in the office, women tended to be in the office earlier. So usually, they would drop off kids and
Go
go
to the
to the
office.
office. And most managers, being men, they would tend to be in the office later. So if a woman would turn up at 8 o'clock, they would be in the office. The manager would probably turn up at 9:30, 10. So already the woman would have worked 2 hours and he would not have seen her there. Then the issue of lunch breaks, women tended to have a very quick lunch break because they needed to leave early. So therefore, you know, a woman would have half an hour lunch break. The average man would have an hour plus. And yes, women tended to leave early because they already done their hours. And most the culture was such that important meetings would take place after 6 o'clock. And of course, after 6 o'clock, not many women were in the office. But if you talked about how many hours were worked by men and women, it was quite clear that women worked longer hours. So another misconception was produced. I can tell you lots of these things that were proven wrong. Another thing, I remember I was in the cabinet at that time. We had about 120 ambassadors in various places in the world. And there was everybody believed that women don't want to go to difficult places. And at that time, we had a woman in Haiti, a woman in Sudan. We only had
Oh.
four or five women, but they were in the most complex, insecure places that, you know, in Libya and things like this. But in most people's minds, it was women don't want to work in difficult places. And if we look at what's happening today, I think the number, for example, of ambassadors are, I think it's risen to about 30, with most of the women working in external, in external, in EIS, the external service of the European Commission, being women. So normally there shouldn't be a reason why ambassadors are less than the 50% that are the women in that service. But nonetheless, this is where we are.
Let's go to the woman that's probably got the most difficult job. that we both know that no man would have attempted, and that's Special Representative Francesca Albanese, which I
Excellent.
don't, I mean, you look at her and you think, firstly, she's most of our sheroes because she's doing some, she's speaking the truth, and she's walking the walk. But I know you're part of a campaign in support of her, and you garnered, and I also saw you had a meeting with my friend, Ambassador Amal Jadu, the
Yes.
Palestinian ambassador to the EU and to Liechtenstein. Tell us about that campaign, because I think it's really important that it's not just civil society rising up in support of Albanese and what she stands for, but that you also get the decision makers or people in policy making positions or with influence. Tell us about that initiative.
Okay, this actually started in July this year, when I met one of ex-colleague, ex-ambassador of the EU, and I said, we have to do something. I have to speak out. I know that the EU is not playing its part. I know anybody's worked for the EU knows it's not that I have any special
Powers or information.
yes, it's in the treaties. If anybody reads the treaties, the EU should have taken specific action to meet its obligations vis-à-vis what is happening in Gaza, and it hasn't done so. And that's we did. Decided that maybe if we write an open letter and get a few people, we were at that stage saying if we get 10 ex-ambassadors to sign, it would be a success and maybe some people will publish it. So something that started in July, in the last intervention we did in October, where we were speaking about also the so-called peace plan. 419 ambassadors from member states, from ex-ambassadors of the EU, something like 30 ex-director generals of the EU, and quite a few ex-foreign ministers co-signed this declaration. So this is an initiative that neither I or I think anybody else on that on that list of 400 plus names has ever done before. And
And what was included? What was the essence of the declaration?
the declaration basically we're calling for two things. One is for the EU to do what's in the treaties. To take the action that it should have taken. And the second thing is for the EU member states, because they also have a role, to take the actions they should have taken according to their obligations, because they're signatories of the International Court of Justice and on the International Criminal Court, and because they're members of the UN.
How many are actually doing that? How many of the member states are actually doing that?
There are some very bright examples. Ireland,
Spain, I
for
think, and Spain.
Spain, Ireland, but also some other countries which maybe were slow to start, like the Netherlands, that recently has said that they will start proceedings against Israeli soldiers which were visiting the
Their
Netherlands.
countries,
And
yes.
yes, and because according to the ICJ, there are indications that there is a genocide happening in Gaza, then these people are subject to international law, and they have arrested some of these ex or I don't know current soldiers that have been visiting. So
Some of them even came to Cyprus, although we have a government that is has a very warm relationship with Israel. But we won't go into that. I mean, they do not reflect the majority of the civil society, because the
I
demonstrations here
am
are quite
I am
strong.
appalled. I am appalled, and I don't mind using a word like that. And that's how I actually got motivated to accept to be part of electoral list coming up for a member of parliament in the next elections. It was not on my radar screen, and I did not want to do that, particularly at this stage in my life. But one of the things I started to look at when the Gaza crisis started was the humanitarian aspects, because I was director for humanitarian operations in the European Union before I went to Pakistan. At that time, I covered Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So humanitarian is something that is very, very close to my heart. Once you are a humanitarian, you
You
always
never
continue.
change, yes.
So when I heard that my government was promoting a plan to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza, they call it Amalthea. It's a proposal for a maritime humanitarian corridor. I was pleased, I was happy, and I started to look at the details. And the more I looked, the more I was shocked, and the more I was appalled. In a nutshell, this was a proposal which basically cost USAID, because the majority of the money came from USAID. It cost the American taxpayer, let's say, $230 million. $230 million. It actually worked, despite the announcements, for about 20 days. And it delivered at best, because I can explain the detail, but it delivered at best enough food for half a day.
For how many people?
Then usually before the crisis happened, there were about 500 to 600 trucks of humanitarian aid going into Gaza. So at best, about 200 trucks were delivered. But when I say delivered, because the UN organizations were against this initiative, because it bypassed all the infrastructure and all the UN mandated organizations on the ground. At some point, WFP, which is the World Food Program, refused to deal with it. Excuse me. And when aid was delivered on the coast in Gaza, WFP refused to even pick it up. Yes.
Was intended and might have lined a few
That I
pockets.
don't know, but there is.
No, that I mean that's and we're not saying who it lined, but obviously when obviously was not used, all the money was not used in the way it
Yes,
was
so it
intended.
was an initiative that neither the Palestinians asked for, nor the UN organizations, nor it was efficient. And there is even a declaration from the spokesman of the White House, basically saying this is an outrage and we should not happen. Recently, President Chrysoulidis, in his address at the UN in September, mentioned this initiative again, and now this initiative is promoted as a way of getting rubble out of Gaza. So
Of
I leave it
Gaza.
at that for. I won't comment further.
Okay. Anyway, let's go to the other subject that's very topical, and it's this Gaza peace plan promoted by Trump that was voted unanimously by the
Yes.
Security Council. Well, I mean, I think it's an appalling plan, but I'm not a, I don't know enough, but it doesn't look to me that the intention is to resettle the Gazans or give the option for people to come back. It's a real
Okay,
estate.
but let me just
So but you know more than me, and that's why you're gonna
Okay,
have a floor.
so the plan, which is very, very short. I mean, usually peace plans are 20, 30, 50, whatever number of pages. It's with a lot
With
of
a lot of
details. This
details.
is a plan of 20 points, basically. And it's split into two phases. It was the ceasefire.
Which has already been broken. The
Repeating.
ceasefire was broken an hour
Yes.
after it was after it
So
was
there's the
announced.
ceasefire phase with the exchange of prisoners and also the return of the remains of any hostages that were killed in the process. That was the first phase. Second phase was the so-called rebuilding of Gaza and the longer future of Gaza. Now, I just want to remind that in the September UN General Assembly, the total number of countries that recognized Gaza, Palestine, as a state was
Palestine.
157 countries out of 193. So the
A
vast
strong
majority of
majority.
countries recognized the state of Palestine. Now, in this 20-page plan, the what will happen and when will happen, if it will happen, the creation of the state of Palestine, it's not really defined or analyzed. In the plan, it also talks about that there will be no annexations and no further taking over of Gaza. But what is happening on the ground is something totally different. What used to be the Gaza Strip is now split into two parts. 53% of the ground, which is given the name as the Green Zone, is controlled by Israel, and the 47% is the Red Zone, controlled by Hamas or whoever you want to mention that controls that part. All the reconstruction that has been announced will only take place, I underline, only take place in the green part. In the green part, green zone, out of the 2 million, 2 million point 2 Gazans. In the green zone, there's about 150 to 200,000 Gazans. The vast majority of the Gazans are in the red zone. So the vast majority of the Gazans will be in a zone where there's no water, no electricity. There's 61 million tons of rubble with unexploded bombs and ordnance
Bombs, or
there.
yes.
Nothing would take place there. So, again, it's splitting the territory of Gaza from an already overpopulated Gaza Strip. Now they have less than half of the area with nearly all the Gazans there. The plan also does mentions about a force that will implement the agreement. It does not specify. It's not a peacekeeping force. It's a stabilization force, and it does not mention who would be part of it. Details on what would be their mandate specifically.
But tell me why was this voted
Well,
in?
that's a mystery to me. In fact, it went through with 13 votes out of the 15.
Who voted
Russia
against?
and China abstained. Both,
Okay. The usual
yes. Both
suspects are
saying
usually
yes.
either
Both
against or
saying
they
that this
abstain.
is not detailed enough. We don't know what we're voting into things. And importantly, this is the only plan that has gone through the UN, which has no reference, no zero reference to any UN resolution. Usually a peace plan would say according to resolution X, Y, Z. There have been so many
Yes.
resolutions on the Israelo-Palestinian conflict, on human rights, on equality, inclusivity, you name it, all of them, none of
Rebuilding,
it, none. There's no reference to anything which is based on previous, let's say, experience or
or based on previous facts, because things happened and resolutions were taken regardless of whether they were implemented. Resolutions were made according to what was happening on the ground. So what's its value?
Well, I think you could be an optimist or a pessimist. I like to be also a realist. Since it's a plan which is, does not specify a lot of things, and I forgot to mention one very important thing, is that 90% of the infrastructure of Gaza is destroyed. It doesn't mention reparations for the
Rebuilding,
cost of that.
yeah.
And
Reparation.
I have to also underline that a lot of that infrastructure was financed by European taxpayers' money, which basically has now been ruined. So I close that parenthesis. So,
Which is one more reason why the EU
exactly.
should be stronger.
If you have something that is very sketchy and not detailed enough, it allows for negotiations down the line. Now, if you're an optimist, you say,
It also allows for recreating circumstance because something else was intended when it was written, and then if it's not clear, you can interpret
okay,
it in whatever way you
exactly.
want.
So you could think that because there were so many countries speaking out, that in the next phase, the details, which normally the devil is in the details, that will have to be figured out, would make this plan a much more concrete and viable plan. You could say no, if there was any chance of defining a viable plan, it would have already been in the plan since they were negotiating this thing for such a long time. But I think one of the most problematic issues is that it does not specify what will happen with the recognition of the state of Palestine that 157 countries have actually come out and supported. Yes. And
Recognized.
the other thing is that it does not mention anything about the West Bank.
And the West Bank is such a fluid environment at this stage. Things are happening that are
Violence
beyond
has
belief.
increased. The take up of Palestinian land and aggression against Palestinian has been increasing dramatically, and therefore, again, ambiguities or omissions, on purpose omissions, you can put whatever word you want there, of this plan. At the end of the day, I want to believe that the bad situation that has existed in Gaza is not going to continue, but I'm realistic.
Even though the ceasefire has not
Yes.
actually been implemented, no, has not
Yes,
lasted. It lasted
Francesca
an hour.
Albanese in her speech yesterday in the parliament, where she got a standing ovation, and she said that she was it was the day after the plan was approved in the UN. She said
Politico.
that this puts the last nail in the coffin of the Palestinian state. That's how she characterized it.
Well, to me, that's what it is because it doesn't speak about recognition. It doesn't speak about right to return. It doesn't speak about reparations and helping to rebuild the Palestinian state or this place where the Palestinians live. So to me, it's we've got a plan in place. Everyone, we've shut everyone up and let's just do what we were going to do in the first place. The other thing that's worrying, though, is that if the ceasefire gets out of hand, what happens? Trump will leave the floor open to Netanyahu to do what he wants.
Will he? I think the track record of that relationship is quite clear that the answer is yes. We've seen. I mean,
Okay.
we don't have to look
I
very
agree.
deeply to find out how that's going to evolve.
I mean, I think it was almost a rhetorical question, but I needed to say it. But because we would like to leave some positivity before we close this conversation, is there anything, have you got any hope beyond having someone like Francesca Albanese, who cannot do this
No.
alone? I mean, she does need, is there
I
any
think
hope?
there is, and the hope is in the thousands and millions of people that have been demonstrating. It's in the various groups of people that have taken action. I mean, we talked about what I am doing as from my side, the group of ex EU ambassadors. But there is, for example, and that gives me a lot of hope, a group of people working for the European institutions. It is called EU for Peace. Out of this, something like 25 to 30,000 people working for the EU institutions, there are about 2,000 people that are actively involved in this. And they're also trying to say, excuse me, we are a union based on values
Respectful,
and human
yes,
rights
values,
and all of
respect for
this,
human rights and
and
stuff like
trying
that.
to push the EU to do the right thing. And in fact, yesterday Albanese thanked this group, the current staff. Yeah, the
The EU
current
for
staff of
peace.
the EU. And he says, thank you for being more civil and less servants. And I love that comment.
Well, that's a lovely comment. It's a
Yeah.
lovely way to put it. Okay, I think that's a good note to end on. And I always enjoy conversations with
Likewise,
you. And maybe we will have another
Magnum.
conversation. And maybe we'll have a conversation on something else going forward. And wishing you good luck in the upcoming
No,
ministerial
Parliament.
MP, MP parliamentary elections. We need good people in Parliament, and we also need people that walk the talk and don't just do things according to personal gain or political, the party policy, but actually walk the talk of what's right and
Thank you
what's
very
wrong.
much, and always available. I always love talking to you too, so.
So thank you, Rulamo, and have a
Thank
great
you.
rest of the day. And to the listeners, thank you for listening.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.